This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello and welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today, I'm talking to Professor Kieran McCartan, a professor in criminology at the University of the West of England, UWE, and to Dr. Anna Markham, a forensic psychologist and acting clinical lead for the Child and Adolescent Harmful Behaviour Service at Oxford Health NHS Foundation Trust. Both Kieran and Anna will be presenting at an ACAM Day conference on October the 4th in Bristol, focusing on harmful sexual behaviour in children and young people.
I'm Professor Kieran McCartan. I'm a professor of criminology at the University of the West of England. My background is I've got an undergraduate in psychology. I've got a MSc in clinical criminology from the Scarman Centre, which is now the Department of Criminology at Leicester, and a PhD in psychology from Leicester as well. And my background is really about public and professional understandings of sexual abuse and how that translates into the integration of people who have committed sexual abuse back into the community. My day job is that I teach criminology undergraduate. I supervise PhD students. And then I'm also involved in a lot of international and national networks, having being a board member of the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abuse and the National Organization for the Treatment of Sexual Abuse as well.
My name is Dr. Anna Markham, and I am the acting clinical lead for an NHS service, which works with children and young people where there are concerns around sexually problematic behaviour. We work across two counties, in Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire.
And what prompted your own interest in this area? What made you get involved in this particular field?
It's strange. I don't think there was one thing that prompted it. There wasn't a high-profile media story, or there wasn't a conversation while I was doing my A-levels or qualifications that really drove me into researching this area. I think I got into it because I just wanted to understand why, compared to all other types of offences, that people who commit sexual offences are viewed in the way that they are, and why there is a perspective in society about them that is very different from other types of violent offenders and from other types of antisociality. So it was really what was linked to it rather than something that happened to me or something that I saw on the news.
Actually, the extent of the problem really sort of, you know, over 10 years ago, I was working in a secure training centre where children are sent to kind of present with higher risk behaviours. And really we were seeing increased numbers where those behaviours involved sexual harm. So I think due to, you know, the increased incidence, that kind of prompted my interest. And actually also it's about, you know, early prevention as well. So those children, you know, it's very rewarding working with children, young people who are in that period of self, you know, formation, identity formation, developing attitudes and knowledge. And actually then it's about thinking about preventing future harm to others and supporting those children and young people in developing, you know, healthy attitudes and living, you know, fulfilling their full potential.
Right. Just taking a step back, it's a very sort of simple question, but what is harmful sexual behaviour in children and young people? What does it encompass? Is it about harm to others, harm to self? Perhaps a bit of a definition would be helpful.
Yeah, I think a really helpful way to see kind of harmful sexual behaviour is to think about it as a continuum. So Professor Hackett, you know, has kind of developed this continuum really right from kind of inappropriate up on, you know, up to kind of abusive or violent. So I think that question, although you said it was simple, actually it's a little bit more complex than that, because you know, depending on the child's age, their kind of what point they are in their development, you know, will really influence and impact on how that behavior is defined and whether it would be inappropriate, you know, how that child responds to kind of instruction or intervention, whether that behavior then continues or doesn't continue. So I think it's most helpfully seen as that kind of continuum.
What does it encompass?
The $64,000 question. So I would start off by saying that all behavior and all sexual behavior is not necessarily problematic. The major reason why it becomes problematic is about understanding and consent and how people see themselves and their sexuality and their sexual behavior. Because what we have to recognize is that sex in and of itself isn't problematic. It becomes problematic when it's against people's will, when people don't consent to it, they don't understand what they're getting involved in or how it impacts upon them or other people. So the first thing that I would always say is that harmful sexual behavior is about consent, and it's about understanding sex and sexuality and sexual behavior and how that translates into relationships and interactions. It's also about what people understand sex to be. So whether that is sexting, whether that's downloading illegal images, whether that's coercing other people to perform acts on you or perform acts for you against their will. So I always find when we talk about sex and harmful sexual behaviors that it's a quite a muddied area, because there's aspects of it that, if consensual, aren't problematic. But we also got to keep in mind when we think about children and young people that some aspects of this behavior can be developmental, and some aspects of this behavior can be them exploring themselves and other people as they're growing. But I would say the core is understanding and consent and context is the core to understanding what is really harmful sexual behavior across the board, but especially in children and adolescents.
Kieran, you have a track record of public, academic and professional engagement on criminological issues, including the origins and causes of sex offending. What factors put a young person at risk of harmful sexual behavior?
I think the factors that you're looking at in this context really come down to socialization and aspects of interactions and how they see relationships and how they view themselves and other people. So if you start to think about a lot of work that has been done in the minute around adverse childhood experiences, trauma-informed care, what we see is that harmful sexual behavior doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from somewhere. Whether people experience sexual abuse themselves, whether they're experiencing harmful sexual behavior to other people and they're observing it, or whether they're watching and viewing things beyond their age and capability. Sometimes harmful sexual behavior also comes from not understanding what they're actually involved in and what they're doing, and that other people aren't giving consent, and that other people aren't going along with what they want to do. A lot of these are similar factors that put adults at risk of harmful sexual behavior as well. And what I would say is, when we start to think about children and adolescents and why they're involved in what they do, we have to look at them as individuals. We have to look at what motivates them and why they want to do what they're doing. Is it attention? Is it replication? Is it actually that this is just symbolic of other problems, other forms of antisociality, other forms of acting out? So what I would say is, people tend to think that these things can happen in isolation. These things rarely happen in isolation. There's other things going on around the child that influence and impact them. And one of the ways that this can come out is through harmful sexual behavior, but you wouldn't be surprised to see other forms of harmful behavior coming out as well.
In our service, we see also high, again, that high proportion have experienced kind of some sort of adversity within childhood, and that could be exposure as well to domestic violence or inappropriate kind of sexual materials. We also see a large number of children with kind of neurodevelopmental, atypical presentations, for example, children with autism and also with learning disability. They're also, you know, these children are overrepresented in our client group. And I think if you think about, you know, with autism, for example, you know, children with autism often have difficulty in understanding some of the nuances around social interactions. And particularly, I think with the advent of, you know, children now using iPads and iPhones more frequently. And actually, I think, you know, the average age of children now being exposed to perhaps an indecent image or pornography online is about 11. And that's not intentionally actively looking for, let's say, an inappropriate image. That could be just as a random pop-up or, you know, kind of on YouTube, the kind of fifth video down could potentially have some quite inappropriate images. And particularly children who do have learning disabilities or kind of that atypical neurodevelopmental, you know, disability, you know, interpret those things probably in a very different way from other children. So a lot of our children, young people in our service do have those sorts of difficulties, and that, I suppose, you know, might predispose them to developing sexually harmful behavior or engaging in that behavior.
Tell me about your clients. Who are the children and the young people that come to see you, and what are the issues that they might be struggling with?
Yeah, so the youngest child that has been referred to our service was probably about 3 years of age, right up until kind of 17, 18, we work up until that age range. So, most young people, I would say the vast majority of the children, young people we see, have developmental kind of and relational traumas within their background, and that can involve physical abuse, neglect, emotional abuse. And I think it's really important to point out that that doesn't mean that most people, for example, who are, you know, have experienced sexual abuse go on to harm others sexually. But what it means is that the population that we see, there is particularly high prevalence of kind of trauma and neglect within that population. And I suppose, you know, we cover a vast range of different kind of referral behaviors that might be online. So, for example, accessing indecent images of children, or that could be inappropriate touch. It could be using sexualized language, right up until sort of those children who perhaps have come to the attention of the criminal youth justice system, who may have, perpetrated rape against other children. So quite a broad spectrum, I think. You know, if we think about children are embedded, aren't they, within kind of, you know, wider systems. So the child, and then you have, you know, the family, the peers, school, and then kind of wider community, don't you? So I think all of those systems have a role, I suppose, in, you know, identifying behaviours that, you know, could be of concern to others. It's tricky to know what, you know, in terms of telltale signs. I mean, I think, some people, children might be potentially more vulnerable. If we think about, you know, some children's social skills and how they go about forming relationships, or where they're learning about kind of messages about sex and relationships from. You talked about kind of, you know, family work, and that's really interesting, isn't it? Because family can be such a important and play a very important role in supporting children developing healthy attitudes and kind of sex education, as well as school, and not kind of leaving it for children to find out about themselves or relying on kind of friends.
What are the telltale signs that a child or young person's at risk of offending sexually?
Well, one of the things that we have seen through research is withdrawal, lack of communication, acting out. So, for instance, with adults, you can see quite often complex grooming behaviours that you wouldn't see in children. They wouldn't act in that way. They wouldn't act out in that way. But you might see that if they are acting out through playing video games, or acting out through harmful play in the playground, that actually there are other signs there that actually there's something not quite right, that they're not acting normally. And big changes in children's personalities and the way that they behave and the way that they act is always a good place to start. So if you have a child that acts in a certain way for a long period of time, then suddenly their behavior changes. Maybe their behavior changes towards a sibling or a pet or a friend or an adult. And there's a warning sign that there's something there, and that actually you should be investigating that and seeing what that warning sign is and trying to respond to it.
And who would normally pick up on that warning sign? Would it be families or health professionals or teachers?
Well, you would like to think families, but we know that sometimes the people who are most vulnerable in regard to offending behaviour are people that may come from disengaged families, that may not have the family support structure and network there that they need. So it might be teachers, because the one thing that we have to recognise is that there's a number of common denominators in most children and adolescents' lives. So their GPA, teachers, clubs and organisations that they go to and that they're involved in. So we would all like to say that it would be the parents and that it would be the home, but it might well be that support structure around them. And schools are a key place that actually most children and adolescents engage with, and that sort of puts teachers in schools on the front line of identifying changes in behaviour.
How much awareness and understanding is there amongst educators, and I suppose health professionals too, it could be GPs or other school counsellors and so on. How much awareness and understanding is there about harmful sexual behaviour amongst children and young people?
There are a number of challenges around this. I think that teachers are aware of some of the signs, but I also think that teachers have so much exposure to so many children and so much going on, that actually, unless things come to the surface, that something gets reported or somebody acts out in class, they may not be aware of the reality or the scope of it, because we know that people who are not only victims of harmful sexual behaviour but also commit harmful sexual behaviour aren't going to talk about this to a vast array of people. So they may realise that the student's a little bit more disengaged, a little bit more removed from what's happening. Maybe they're not coming to class. Maybe they're not performing as well as they did. And they may know some of the telltale signs of this, but actually, given the amount of students that they have to come into contact with, it may be difficult unless actually someone comes forward to say, there's a problem, or I'm actually quite concerned about this, to pick up and be able to respond to it. But I think there's always an opportunity for more advice and for more training around this. I think what you end up seeing is a bit of a postcode lottery. And with the changes purportedly coming in within the next couple of years to relationship advice and sex and sexuality in schools, hopefully we will start to see more of this. Although the reality of this is we need more of this work in primary schools being done and teachers being upskilled in primary schools, because there's still an idea that actually harmful sexual behaviour is something that we talk about at secondary school level. However, we know that actually young children can engage in harmful sexual behaviour and be exposed to it as well. So the reality is we need to start thinking about this earlier. And a lot of the legislation and consultation at the minute is talking about secondary schools and not necessarily primary schools. And when you start to think about reports that have been done over the past 5 or 6 years into sexting and into harmful sexual behaviour by organisations like the NSPCC, we see that there's children in primary schools engaging in this behaviour, so it's not simply just a secondary school issue.
I'm assuming if you see this type of behaviour in a very young child, there's an assumption that there's been sexual abuse or some of the adverse childhood experiences that you touched on before. Is that always going to be the case, or is that a dangerous assumption to make?
I think it's a dangerous assumption to make. I don't think that you shouldn't make it. What I think you should do is think about it in the context of everything. So when we think about these things, we shouldn't be thinking, this child's at harm, the most obvious person committing the harm is the parent, let's take the child off the parent. That may not be the reality of the situation. It may be someone else. If there is any harm going on whatsoever, it could simply be replications of things that they see, whether watching age inappropriate television or engaging with YouTube or talking about things through online gaming or whatever it happens to be. We just can't assume that if someone is displaying harmful sexual behaviors, that that's because they have been a victim of similar harmful sexual behaviors themselves, and they're simply replicating or trying to do to other people what someone has done to them. But it could be that they have sort of learned through vicarious experiences of hearing about it from other people, viewing some of it, or engaging in it in an online forum. So we just can't always assume that what we're seeing is some sort of cycle of abuse being played out in real time.
What is the impact on the parents, say, of children who exhibit harmful sexual behaviour, and how can they be helped? Is the whole family helped?
I think one of the issues that we have around this is, you know, most parents tend to think, have I done something? Is there something that we have done as a family that has led to this? And there may not have been. There may have been, but there may not have been. And I think that families struggle with this because of the way that we think about sex in general and morality, and the way that we talk about it, and the way that we talk and think about the fact that children aren't sexual beings, and the way that we think that suddenly once you get to 16, something happens and you become sexualized. That's not how sexual development works. But the reality of what you see is families may not come forward, may not seek support, may try to deal with it in another way where they either punish the child or chastise the child. And actually, we need to be at a point where if they're concerned about their child's well-being, if they've got concerns about their child's behaviour, or that they're talking about harmful sexual behaviour, they're engaging in certain practices that they think will result in it, they need to be able to come forward and get help and get support to stop the child from committing a harmful sexual behaviour if that's the direction they fear it's going, because no one benefits from being a victim of sexual abuse, and no one benefits from committing it. I always think about it in the context of conversations around drug use. You know, that, you know, the best way to get off heroin or to get access to methadone is to be caught taking it. No one needs to commit sexual harm to get help to prevent them from committing sexual harm. And actually, if we're seeing that children are displaying certain behaviours that we're concerned about, there should be the capability for a lot of parents to come forward and say, actually, I think my child needs some help. Can you help me?
Why is it important, say, to focus, and I suppose this will come to treatments in part or interventions, why is it important to focus on the family as opposed to solely working with the individual?
I think if we think about who the main influencers on children's lives could be, it will be the family who provide those in-moment learning opportunities and are going to potentially, you know, we're talking about children who are remaining in their family homes, but are potentially there for those children's long lifespan. So if we can upskill parents, carers, to be comfortable and to be able to kind of, you know, be open and transparent in kind of conversations about healthy relationships, sexual consent, that's going to have much more of a long-lasting impact than taking an approach where we see the child as problematic and, you know, having kind of seeing it as more kind of an individual focus. Because, you know, you need parents or carers or whoever's in that child's life every day to be reinforcing those skills and also, you know, that kind of okay, not okay in relationships. And that, because, you know, to learn about relationships, they need to be doing and being in those relationships. So that's why the family or any kind of, you know, main key workers are really the most probably important in any kind of intervention.
But what about the impact on the parents who have children who exhibit harmful sexual behaviour? How can they be helped?
Our service run a parent support group where there has been kind of sexually problematic behavior kind of within the family between siblings, because I think, you know, as understandable, many of the parents or carers that, where children have engaged in harmful sexual behavior often feel shamed. They often feel kind of helpless. They feel, they blame themselves potentially. They might not understand their child's behavior. So I think, as professionals as well, it's really important to involve parents to be able to try and understand a little bit and not kind of demonize that child, and understand perhaps how that behavior came about, as well as be able to kind of do safety planning as well to support in that behavior not reoccurring.
Right. I want to come to interventions in a little bit, but I just wondered how much awareness there is amongst health professionals and teachers and anyone else that these young people will come across or who will come across them about harmful sexual behaviour. And I think it's interesting when you use the word demonise, because I wonder if that happens even amongst educators and teachers. And, I wonder how those children are perceived and helped.
Yeah, absolutely. My experience is it's highly variable, really, among, as well as healthcare professionals, education, staff, school responses to incidents is very variable as well as, police decision making. That's my experience. I mentioned the word demonized, but, I think there continues to be a lot of professional anxiety around sexually harmful behavior among children.
What happens if a young person is not able to access help or isn't identified as needing help? What typically might happen to that person?
Well, in a worst case scenario, they may go on to offend. They may go on to either download and look at inappropriate images. They may go on to coerce people to have images taken of them or take images of other people. They may go on to commit a contact offence. But what we also say is that it can play out in other ways, in aspects of self-harm, whether that's through drug use, whether that's through the use of alcohol, whether that's through other forms of intoxication. What you also may say is it may result in other forms of trouble. So maybe violent behaviour, maybe antisociality. What we tend to say is that when things aren't dealt with, they come out in a variety of different ways, which is one of the problems with the field of sexual harm, because it's not simply that everyone goes on to sexually harm if that's their inclination or they feel that that's what they're going to do. It may come out in other ways as well. So I would strongly encourage anyone that thinks that we've got a concern or we're concerned about our child's behavior or adolescent's behavior to actually start to seek help, because what you might end up seeing is through no fault of that child, it may come out in another way, because actually they will get more and more frustrated with it, and without someone to talk to or some sort of support structure, they may go on to either commit sexual harm or some other form of harm to themselves or someone else.
I guess the research would suggest that most children do not go on to, continue in that behaviour. If we looked at kind of reconviction rates, and obviously that's a very specific population because these children have already had a conviction, you're looking at kind of, around 10 to 14%. So I think, it's sometimes about reassuring the adults that most young people won't go on to continue within adulthood. And, really important in, child and adolescence is then thinking about building on those resilience factors. So, for example, having a positive engagement with school, education, or some sort of employment. Thinking very carefully then, within police decision making around kind of impact of a criminal justice response. And in some cases that, could be proportionate, but in other cases, perhaps what does that mean for that child in terms of how they're able to build a future?
Well, this is one of the issues around this. Prevention and the prevention of sexual harm is gaining in stature, and people are starting to think about sexual abuse in ways that are not just criminal justice orientated, that are health orientated and mental health orientated and public health orientated. However, there isn't a vast array of services out there, but you know, I would sort of steer parents who are concerned about this towards the Lucy Faithful Foundation, towards the NSPCA, as organisations that can help them around this.
How do you think you'd have that conversation? Because, as you've already said, in society, I would say in popular parlance, there's a tendency to think of sexual offenders as, let's say, bad, not mad, if you'll excuse the expression. And therefore, there is this belief that they should be dealt with through the criminal justice system rather than it being seen as a public health issue. So how do you engage the public in that argument, or counter that argument, I should say?
I think there's a couple of ways of doing this. So I think the first one is things like this podcast, getting the conversation out, hearing a multitude of different sides to the story. I think it's about people recognizing that we're not excusing harmful sexual behavior, that we're not saying that it's not a big deal, because it is a big deal. However, we're saying that these things don't happen in isolation. It's the same with crime and criminogenic behavior. It doesn't happen in isolation. Things happen across people's lifespans that lead them down a pathway to that. And if we can intervene and stop some of those things happening, we can reduce offending behavior and we can reduce problematic behavior. I also think it's about a more engaged media. And I know the media is a vast, complex beast of an organization, but actually, you know, having appropriate conversations, having debates through things like a good example might be something like On Road Media and the Angles Project, and I know they did a lot of work and engaging with the press. But one of the biggest things that I've heard across the years is the positive impact of social platforms that people already engage with. So when you talk to charities and organizations, they talk about getting their Twitter accounts out there, and they talk about, oh, you know, we need this campaign and we need that campaign. And I can think of some campaigns that have really worked. So whether it's things like Pantasaurus, that's really worked, that's really engaged children, because that's come down to their level and got them on board. But one of the other things that's really worked, which is quite unique to the UK, I think, is things like soap operas. When EastEnders and Hollyoaks and Coronation Street run informed, engaged storylines, people respond to them and people see them, because these shows are in their homes 4 or 5 nights a week. They can follow the narrative. They can see the narrative being played out in front of them. And when a friend of mine did his PhD research, and he said, you know, would you ever pick up a leaflet or do anything like that to learn more about harmful sexual behavior? What he heard back from people in the general public was no. But, you know, if it's what I engage with, then I will learn more, whether it's reading Take a Break or looking at EastEnders. The reality is, if you come to where people live and have the conversation with them through language that they can engage with, it will have a more positive response than simply expecting them to come to you and engaging with your material.
So how do you go about relaying that to the relevant professionals? I'm wondering whether those professionals know where to get advice. And
yeah, I mean, we do a lot of training. So, I mean, there's also a lot of overlap, if you think about kind of with looked after children and foster carers. So we, you know, recently have done some training with foster carers to think about how they understand and how they define, and really supporting professionals to think about the language they're using as well, you know, whether a label of dangerous is, you know, necessary or proportionate. So I think there's key agencies and professionals. So, you know, assessing social workers, that kind of first response, because that often there was an incident and that would go to that kind of social care first response team. And also thinking about, you know, chairs that child protection conferences as well. So there are key kind of decision makers who we do a lot of training with to help them really understand about that kind of continuum and how to define, you know, problematic or harmful sexual behaviours among children and adolescents.
And is that how most children would, and young people would get access to your service? How are they normally referred?
And we receive referrals from social care, from the police, from schools, from GPs, from our other colleagues within child and adolescent mental health services. That's our sources of referrals. Our model is primarily based on kind of a consultation model. You know, it wouldn't be appropriate for us to necessarily see every child that's referred to us. A referrer will request a consultation to think about what, you know, the response might need to involve that behaviour.
Anna, I understand you undertake multi-systemic interventions with families. Can you describe the type of interventions that you make?
Yeah, I think we're better using the term kind of systemically informed interventions, I think, because it's a bit different to something like multisystemic therapy, which is used for sexual harmful behaviour, but in quite a very small number of places. I think, as I mentioned before, it's about thinking about the child within their wider environment. So if there is already, you know, a key worker or a teacher or a homeschooling worker who's already built a very good working relationship with that child or young person, it's really thinking about intervening at multiple levels. So it's not just about with, you know, the child directly, let's say. It's about advising the social worker or that key worker. Is there a piece of work that they're in a better position to be able to do and reinforce within school or within home? Or is there, you know, are there contributing factors within the within kind of friendships that need thinking about? So I think in terms of interventions, you know, your most important aspect of that is really making sure that at that initial stage you've gathered all the information that you really need to make a good assessment and a good and develop a good understanding of how it is this behavior has come about. So really, you know, interventions are only as good as the understanding of why the behavior happened, and that really involves that gathering of information from school, from social care if needed, from the family, to develop a shared understanding with, you know, professionals as to what has happened and guess why.
Once you've done that sort of fact gathering exercise and you've worked out who the best people are to deliver the intervention, say, what kind of intervention is used? You use mentalizing, do you?
I think sometimes it's also about thinking about sequencing of intervention. So there's something called the trauma recovery model that's being increasingly used across the kind of youth justice system. And it's thinking about, you know, at that early stage, you know, it goes back to, you know, making sure you're meeting basic needs. So are children in a safe place where even, you know, the basic housing, food, are those met first? So before we would even think about, you know, an intervention kind of for the sexually harmful behaviour, you know, before you're able to perhaps think about kind of cognitive behavioural therapy or, you know, increasing kind of sexual knowledge or understanding, ensuring that those earlier needs are met. Because often these children have much wider needs than just the sexual harmful behaviour. That's just, you know, one aspect potentially. If you have a child, you know, perhaps who isn't in a stable placement, or, you know, he's in a residential care home or she, or, you know, perhaps doesn't know, or in a temporary foster care placement, those kinds of needs need to be prioritised first, as well as thinking about safety to others and to that child. So I think once perhaps some of those more basic needs could be met, then we might be thinking about, you know, who that child has that kind of those positive relationships with, and some of the interventions are then informed perhaps by CBT principles, but also trauma informed, and also, you know, really thinking about that child's age as well, because you know, your intervention is going to be very different for a 4, 5, 6 year old than it would be for a 17, 16 year old, in terms of how, you know, A, the content even, but B, you know, how that even should be or could be delivered to the wider system.
I was wondering on that issue of age, is there a kind of window when intervention is critical? Is it by a certain age?
In my view, no. If we think about, you know, change as all, you know, firmly believing that change is, you know, is possible. If we think about all the kind of developments in neuroscience at the moment and adolescent brain development, and, you know, the kind of changes that are happening in the kind of prefrontal cortex. So I wouldn't say there's a particular certain age. And also, you know, within the adult world, we know that lots of adults are accessing therapeutic interventions as well. So I wouldn't say there was a certain age, but I suppose in general, there's very little research really about, you know, the effectiveness of kind of interventions for children displaying harmful sexual behaviour. But in more general terms, we know that earlier intervention is more effective. That's not specific to harmful sexual behaviour.
I don't think it's like this is not a developmental thing where you sort of start having feelings at the age of 6 or 7 and then start downloading images at 10 or 11, then go on and commit a contact offence of 14 or 15. That it may be that for some people, but this is not necessarily age-related. Intervention needs to come at the point where the individual feels that actually there's something wrong here and I need some sort of help. This may be when they're at their most withdrawn, they're most isolated, and they're most vulnerable. And it's up to the people around that individual to be able to tap in and say, you know, there's something going on here. It's not the same person. It's not the same child that we have seen before. Something has changed in this child. And then try to intervene at that point. Because one of the things that I think that people think sometimes when I've had conversations in the broader public sphere is that, oh, well, we just have to wait till it's a bit later because we don't talk about sex really with 7, 8 year olds. We wait till they're a little bit older. And actually, if children are developing sexually, both in terms of their psychology and in their bodies, they're starting to have these conversations in primary school, in year 3, in year 4, that actually parents need to be more engaged in the process and not be afraid to have these conversations, especially if they think there's something happening that they're a bit concerned about. So it's not age related. I would say it's context related, and we know our own children better than other people do.
Right. What type of interventions work? Can you tell me a little bit about the interventions?
So a lot of the interventions that we see around harmful sexual behaviour are mainly talking interventions, whether they're cognitive behavioural therapy or psychoeducational interventions. And they really focus around getting the individual to recognise that their harmful sexual behaviour or their thoughts around harmful sexual behaviour aren't appropriate, and getting them to think about themselves and other people within the same context. So it may be about attitudinal change, that maybe this isn't the way that we act around other people. And so you use certain language processes and certain role modeling and social skills around it as well. That's what the vast majority is. So it's almost like aspects of coaching and training about this is appropriate relationships, this is what they look like, and this is how you interact with them. Now, if it then turns out that there are other factors feeding into this, either mental health problems or other forms of social anxiety, or actually other forms of harmful sexual behaviors that have happened to them, or adverse childhood conditions that have happened to them, then they get dealt with in another way. But the intervention is about getting people to recognize and children to recognize what is appropriate and what is inappropriate relationships and sexual behavior.
And what evidence is there that that type of early intervention works, let's say, and also reduces that person's likelihood of offending?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed bag, to be honest. A lot of what we would refer to as secondary intervention in this context, as well in a public health context, working with at-risk populations, is a real mixed bag of evaluation. And it's reasonably early days because a lot of this work has only been taking place within the past 5 or 6 years. So there aren't the longitudinal studies, there aren't the big rigorous RCTs that you would see in other aspects of sexual harm research. So, but what we do see is that having the conversation, and when you talk to people who run the interventions, it's about skills and skill training and for people to recognize that actually there is an issue and they need to do something about it. And none of these are sort of syringe models. Syringe models don't work well in this context. It's actually giving people the skills, the management skills, to sort of realize that there's a problem with their behavior and what they need to do around it. But I think, you know, some work has been done in the US, pockets of work has been done in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK around this. But there is no massive meta-analysis out there that will say this sort of prevention work work successfully with these populations in this way. We're still evaluating and developing a lot of the work around this as it's emerging.
I know you said there's been little research, but can you talk about any of the research that is ongoing?
So there has been some studies around kind of MST, which is multisystemic therapy, in this country as well as in America, but, you know, it tends to be very small sample sizes. And, you know, thinking about as well long-term research, I think, you know, there are no accredited programs, for example, for children displaying harmful sexual behavior. So it's quite tricky to then group together various different interventions to then measure the effectiveness long-term. So, you know, very few, that I know of kind of longer term, longitudinal studies of what, you know, of interventions for children and young people. But I think, you know, promising results from kind of cognitive behavioral approaches, which are, you know, which intervene on those multiple systems, you know, the family, the peers, the school, the wider community environment, that are trauma informed and also kind of developmentally appropriate to the child.
Do you feel optimistic? Do you feel sometime down the line that these studies will prove to have shown that early intervention is effective?
I do feel optimistic because I've seen it within our own clinical work that, you know, children who are provided, and not, I don't mean directly, but even systems who are helped to understand how that behaviour could have arisen, that can be a shift in how they interact with that child and what support they then put in place. So I do feel very optimistic about that. So sometimes, I guess a case example, we had a child who had engaged in some harmful sexual behaviour. And, you know, at that very early assessment, it was very clear from the outset that, you know, he presented with autistic spectrum disorders, with an autistic spectrum disorder, and he had kind of, you know, borderline learning difficulties, but that hadn't really been picked up during his primary school years at all. So then at age 10, I think once the professionals around that child understood his needs a lot better, then actually an appropriate education provision could be found for him, where he, you know, was able to then engage with school on a level which he had never done before because he hadn't fully understood. And, you know, he'd found the noise of, you know, a large classroom very difficult, but his behaviours had been labelled as, you know, bad, as naughty. So I think increasing the people were around that child and their understanding of that child's needs, you know, that's what I find, you know, promising and optimistic.
Yes, with a caveat, I suppose. So on one level, I would like them to be successful. So, you know, is that some sort of internal bias around, what the outcomes of this may be and where it may go. But I think the bigger issue, rather than just the interventions are one aspect of it, but we need to start changing the conversation around harmful sexual behaviour in society. This idea that people who commit harmful sexual behaviour are others, are vastly deviant, are completely removed from everyone else in society, is not the case. And we've seen that through things like the Me Too movement, and we have seen that through things like the amount of historical allegations that have came out over the last number of years. And sexual harm and sexual harassment are prevalent in society. And by saying that the people who do this are so radically different from everyone else and are antisocial, and some of them are, but not the vast majority of them, we need to change the conversation. And I do believe that the conversation can change within the context of children and adolescents, because I think that people believe that children and adolescents can change in ways that they don't believe that adult perpetrators across the board can change. There's a view that adults are set in their ways and that once an offender, always an offender, and they will continue down that path. However, I do think when you talk to people, people in the general public do have a view that children can change and that adolescents can change, that they grow out of it, or they change as they become adults and they start to act and think and feel in a different way. So I think interventions, hopefully, can bring to light people's fears and concerns about their own behaviour or other people's behaviour and get them to think about it. But I think we also need to start thinking about how we reframe the conversation around sexual harm is bad, it's destructive, it impacts people's lives adversely for the rest of their lives quite often. It also impacts people who perpetrate it in many, many ways. But people who feel that they're at risk of committing sexual harm and want help should be able to get help before they commit sexual harm, because actually no one benefits, either victims or perpetrators, from sexual harm.
You'll be speaking at the conference in the autumn. Anna, can you give a short summary of the areas you'll be covering?
Yes, so we'll be speaking in Bristol in October supporting people in thinking about, what have the challenges been, to develop, a service that is responsive to children and young people with harmful sexual behaviour, kind of what we'll be outlining, our activities, with young people, but also kind of all that training. And, you talked before about, the importance of raising awareness among other professionals and supporting parents as well to see their role in, helping children develop healthy sexual attitudes and healthy relationships. And we'll also be providing kind of some clinical case studies as well to support the delegates there to understand how we might think about the different clients that referred to our service.
So the areas I plan to cover is an update about research in relation to child and adolescent individuals who commit sexual harm. So in terms of etiology, in terms of treatment, in terms of integration back into it and back into the community. And there's been some promising long-term research done in this area by the likes of Carl Hansen, who have said that actually desistance from sexual harm is the norm across the lifespan, and that reoffending, while happens in some instances, isn't the normal course for people who commit sexual harm, whether adolescents or whether adults. So I'll be talking about some of that work, and then I'll be talking about some of the prevention and early intervention work that is going on both nationally and internationally around this, to sort of give a flavour of what research and practice is out there in respect to children and adolescents with harmful sexual behaviour.
Right. Thank you. Is there anything you'd like to add? Anna, coming to you, perhaps a sort of take-home message for those listening to this podcast.
I think my take-home message would be that, you know, at that, you know, that early stage, you know, the most important thing is about having a good assessment and a good formulation. And a formulation, you know, within psychology, what it means is having a good understanding about how this behavior has come about. And that's really needs to be your starting point. And, you know, you need to spend time doing that rather than perhaps jumping in too early with an intervention.
To me, the take-home message is communication and context. If you're concerned about someone's behavior, if you're concerned about the language and the way that someone acts, communicate with them, get them to try and talk with you about it, and then try and enable them to get help and support so that they don't commit an offense against someone or a harmful behavior against themselves. Because people who commit sexual harm, it has a long-term impact not only upon the victim and the victim's family, but also upon them and their own friends and family. So to me, it's about communication and context.
Thank you ever so much. Professor Kieran McCartan and Dr. Anna Markham will be exploring these themes at the ACAM Day Conference on Harmful Sexual Behaviour in Children and Young People, which takes place in Bristol on October the 4th. They'll also be joined by Dr. Nick Hindley, a consultant child and adolescent forensic psychiatrist at Oxford Health NHS Foundation Trust. You can find details of the conference on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and on Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelt A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.